show up.
All right, could I? Could I?
One of the things slowing it down.
I just thought I'd ask.
No, I appreciate that.
Could I get your attention here? We're going to have a little hubbub in back of us while the IT director of Harvard and our leading AV specialists and a network professor from the university try and get us connected. But I figured that since we're chewing up class time, I could schmooze a little bit with you about what I'm hoping to accomplish today with this experience. David Laser is he's a network guy. He thinks in terms of networks. But it's not like a techie thing exactly. It's much more a mathematical concept. It's much more an idea about how connection works. And it has remarkable ramifications. David leads something here called a complexity workshop. Complexity is a branch now of mathematics in which, well, I don't know, David, are you completely preoccupied here?
This is complexity.
What is complexity, David?
Well, the basic idea of complexity is that the world is made up of lots of processes, which one may characterize as being simple, but at the systemic level, those processes can result in complex and interesting behaviors. And actually, I have a simulation here that I'll offer, if we're lucky, one illustration of that. So that's the basic idea, the sort of micro to macro, simple at the micro level, complex at the macro level, potentially adaptive at the macro level. And that's the idea of
simple at the micro level, complex at the macro level. Well, the first connection that I had with this idea was something called the Mandelbrot set. Anybody familiar with Mandelbrot? Well, the Mandelbrot set is this most amazing visual experience. It actually gives you the impression of being a 3D world that you can move through. And the thing that's extraordinary about the Mandelbrot set is that it's generated, it's computer generated, from a single equation. A single equation. It's like a line long. But it's an equation that is dealt with recursively, which means that the output of the equation becomes the input. And so it operates as a recursive function. And when you look at this thing closely, you see that what's happening is something that gives some suggestion of the way live things develop. You know, seeds that grow into ferns or into trees, and the idea of very similar shapes being repeatedly reiterated, although never identical. So infinite difference and yet infinite similarity. This idea of complexity turns out to be something of interest to people thinking in many different fields. So I was extraordinarily pleased when I had the opportunity of meeting David and asking him to sit down with me and talk to me about networks. Now, so far in our class, we have spoken to a very considerable extent about rhetoric, about the way argument goes together, little bits about the way code goes together and network comes together. But basically, the idea has been working with elements of rhetorical space in a way that creates persuasion. What I'm hoping for, as you see the architecture of network kind of unfold before you from simplest concepts, that will offer a kind of template to integrate what seems to be a tremendously complex thing that's unfolding. That is, when you, in a sense, see the developing complexity from a meta view, you're dealing with patterns of pattern. And at that level, things tend to simplify. That's what I'm looking for, the sense of connection that comes with a graphical representation of a conceptual idea, a way of learning to picture something and to imagine something unfolding. All right, now. How are we doing? Are we?
We're getting closer, I think, but we seem to. Something seems to be soaking up my CPU. So, if that's not a metaphor for life, I'm not sure what is. Well, let me get going while we can do this. Get the PowerPoint up. Oh, is it Firefox? Really.
So, all right, I'm going to let him keep going.
Let me just take one more minute here.
I'm going to keep schmoozing here, all right? So I want to bring a couple of threads together that have been at work in my mind as we've been going forward.
Yeah, that's what I'll do.
I mentioned to you earlier that Charles Ogletree, through the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute, is sponsoring a conference to celebrate the publication of Charles Fried's Modern Liberty. I'm one of the people that will be speaking at that conference, but one of the things that I wanted to connect with and may talk about at the conference is that, to me, Benkler's book dealing with the new networked economy, together with Fried's book on, as he calls it, modern liberty, but I really think he's writing about identity and individuality. Those two things link in my mind with the network and the node. It's like Fried is talking about the philosophy of individuality that actually makes up the node of consciousness that the network then connects. And when we were talking just yesterday, about Marcus Garvey and the influence of Garvey and the fact that this was someone who set about creating buzz, so to speak, for a purpose. He had a mission. He had a philosophy. He had flaws which ultimately led to his being vulnerable to really outrageous power exercised on the other side by J. Edgar Hoover and the forces of surveillance and so forth. But there was this idea and a conscious projection of idea. And linking those things together lead me to want to say, put November 9 on your calendar. Come to this conference. I think it's going to be very interesting. I would hope that we can manage to put it up to the net in some ways so that it's accessible to the widest possible audience. And I see in it an opportunity once again to link the thoughts of internet and society with the Hamilton Institute and the Berkman Center. The Institute basically being the base and the Berkman Center being the amplifier, if we can possibly manage it. And so as an example of the kind of thing that we're talking about at a number of different levels here in the course, that is formulating a thought, projecting it out into the space, developing an audience for it, expressing in a way that has some power and expresses identity. That's what we're looking for. So how are we doing now?
Now I think we are on the penultimate step. All it has to do is to pop up. Let me... I think that should do it, and it should appear any second now. Let me just briefly begin with some background, and then hopefully the PowerPoint will suddenly flash on top of my face. So I'm David Lazar. I'm an associate professor at the Kennedy School of Government down the road. And I am a director of the program on networked governance there, which looks at the governance issues, that arise when you look at interconnected systems. And I'm told I'm supposed to click run, and let's see, bingo. All right, showtime. All right, so So the focus of my program, as well as my own research, is to look at the governance issues that arise in complex systems, in networked systems. And what I want to do today is just to provide a taste of the research on social network analysis. Obviously, this is a large and growing field, so I can't offer much more than a taste, but I think hopefully I'll provide enough to intrigue. I'm going to begin with a definition of what I mean by networks and social network analysis, move into some of the key results that have been produced in the field, and then I think move on to some neat illustrations that actually are out there on the internet that that you could play with at another point in time. The key notion of thinking of the world as networked is to focus on relationships between individuals rather than on the individuals per se. So most social science research really focuses on individuals and characteristics of the individuals. Rich people act this way, poor people act this way. If you're this educated, you do this, and so on. That instead, the idea behind network analysis is rather than looking at the characteristics of the nodes, you look at the characteristics of the relationships among those nodes. And the basic idea here is that the forms, when we look at the room, for example, and we think of where the relationships among you, that the friendship network among you, for example, is fundamentally self-organized. You've made decisions on whether to become friends, whether to go out for lunch, whether to go out for dinner, and the like, and that there is an overarching structure, but it's organized by the individuals in the system, and that's what is meant by self-organized. And one in your own decisions in terms of how to connect with each other may be possible to model in various simple ways, and yet, again, may result in rather complex forms at the macro level. And I want to focus on two issues for today, just to motivate discussion. One is, how does the configuration of the network affect how individuals and systems function? And then second, how does one study networks, which is, after all, what I do? So there are really two levels you should think of when you think about network analysis. One is thinking about the system level. What kind of network characterizes the system? Is it a centralized network? Is it a decentralized network? Is it clustered a lot? Do you find that there are major breakdowns in communication between various groups within the system? And then the question one might ask also at the systemic level is, what kind of network structure results in good outcomes at the system level? So if you look at work that my colleague Bob Putnam has done on social capital, there's a whole set of assertions there about the configuration of the network, what's a good configuration, what's a bad configuration, thinking about it, again, at the very macro societal network level. And the second point is, what is good for the individual? So we might think about what kind of position is good for an individual to be successful, right? And these are different questions, because what might be good for individuals might not be good for the system, because you might think that, for example, a lot of human behavior is really competitive, right? So it might be something that is good for an individual in their competition with other individuals, but it may not be something that is good for the system as a whole. So just as an example of some research I'm doing right now, it's some simulation work looking at the processes of creating information versus finding information. And what we find is that people have if you allow sort of the system to evolve to what is best for the individuals, people tend to go out and look a lot for information, but actually then stop creating information, because there's a trade-off there between creating and finding information, and that, in fact, it turns out that the whole system shifts toward finding information rather than creating information. So what's good for the individual in this particular case turns out to be bad for the system. So there can be a trade-off there between, and I call this sort of a phenomenon, a tragedy of the network, playing off the idea of tragedy of the commons.
Hang on for just a sec, okay?
doesn't sound right to me. All right, so Google comes along, and now I can search like the wind and find stuff left and right. To me, that's just been the most amazing aid in creating all sorts of stuff. Why am I not being assisted in my creativity by research becoming fluid and easy?
Well, what we find in our simulations, let's see here. Should clear a little blackboard place here. Is anyone going to get mad at me if I erase this?
Not seriously.
Okay. I'll put it on you. So what we find is that if you have...
Dean, why don't you flip that light on there so that we can see the board better?
Is this...
it's the one to the left. Yeah, you're good.
Okay. So let's look at performance and time. What we find is that in very well networked world, people can look around and they find, oh, you've got the best solution. So let's all copy Charles. But then we're all stuck with your solution. And we're all starting with that as a starting point, which may turn out actually not to be the best place to be from the long run perspective, because it may turn out that someone else, even though they were doing worse, actually had the pathway to nirvana. So the world becomes very homogeneous very fast in a well-networked world and flatlines. Whereas if you have a poorly networked world, it tends to improve very slowly, but it keeps on going for a long time. Because there's more, it's harnessing the creativity and the problem-solving ability of everyone in the system. So, for example, in research, experimental research on brainstorming groups, turns out actually that brainstorming groups usually think it's better to have everyone in the room, they're bouncing ideas off of each other and so on. Actually, turns out not so good, according to experimental research. Better to have people off in their own rooms, thinking about the problems, and then at the end, they come and they compare notes, and they pick the best solution that each individual came up with. So communication actually sometimes can be very dysfunctional. Now, the one thing we haven't explored is the idea of recombination of different ideas. And so you have half a solution, and I have half a solution. How do we put those together? Right, so we haven't been able to separate out that issue where clearly there's this idea of recombination and the like as compared to the idea that we're trying to copy the most successful people in the system, which then results in this rapid improvement in the short run, but flatlining in the long run.
So I hear it, but I'm not believing it.
Okay.
Take the way legal research has worked.
Yeah.
At the beginning, you couldn't really do any research because there was no system for putting out the output of courts. Yeah. So you had some treatise writers who would say things and you would cite Greenleaf on evidence or something. And that goes on for years and years.
Yeah.
Then somebody comes along in the 1880s, a guy named West, and he figures there's a business in gathering up the reports of all the courts and putting them out in volumes with an index so that people can search the literature that this court system generates. And suddenly, there's a whole generation of scholarship and treatises because people have stuff now to look at. Now, I remember when Lexis came in. It was like 1972 or something. I remember being in my office and having this person come show me that I could put in a request for some kind of search based on Boolean word search and go out to dinner, and I could come back after dinner and there would be an answer.
Yeah.
And it was just so amazing. And now it's like, phoom. Now, does that mean that we're plateauing and everything's getting worse now that we can do research so quickly? I can't believe it.
Well, there's another possibility, because the way you're drawing the picture of legal research was that before, the world looked like this. And here's the treatise, and here are our various researchers, all right? And It functioned in some senses as a hub-spoke network, where the treatise is probably a quite imperfect way of capturing all the richness of material out there. And so what you had suddenly was, a very, in certain ways, it simultaneously homogenized things, because everyone would look at the world through the filter of this treatise, right? And also act as a bottleneck for any other information going through it. So what we've had, you know, with the world today is that we actually get through this bottleneck, and there is actually some information flow and less homogenization, I think, than you had in the pre-Lexis world, in a way. So it doesn't quite fit with the model, exactly with the model that we produce for our simulations, but actually I think the storyline actually in certain ways does fit, that some information flow is necessary and is good for the system, but that things that create homogeneity in the system are bad. And I think that the sort of, this is how I would have painted the picture from before, at least from your description. So moving on. So there are a number of key ideas I want to talk about with respect to network analysis. One are how do networks affect systems, and how do they affect individuals? And I'm going to focus on four key functions that networks play. This isn't an exhaustive list, but I think some of the big ones. One is how networks regulate the behavior of individuals in the network, how they circulate things within the network, how they provide coordination and control for some nodes over other nodes. And then I'm going to talk about some of the more recent research about the structure of macro networks, including the small world research, scale-free networks, and homophily, some of which you may have read about in your readings before the class. So again, I'm going to talk about these four key aspects of how networks affect individuals. Network ideas have hit it big when they hit the comics. But in this one, the dog is saying, really? A can filled with rotten garbage just down the block? And then he thinks, never underestimate the power of networking. Right? And the idea here is, if you're placed well in the network, you get information. And you get information, if you're placed exceptionally well, you can get your dog food faster in life, right? So that before other dogs get there. So if we think about information circulating about jobs, and there's been a lot of research on networks, looking at networks and finding out about jobs, it focuses on how information flows through the network, and being in a privileged position gives you access to information and competitive advantage that you would otherwise not have. Second function to talk about is regulation. You may not be able to read this, but this says, Margaret told Gina that you told her what I told you not to tell her. So don't you dare tell her that I told you she told me what I told you not to tell her. Okay? And the idea here, and let me also keep that in mind, and this one as well. This is it for the comics, I think. I think these actually elucidate some key ideas. This one says, this is sure a small town, Laura. When I went into the bank, the teller knew my name, where I was from, and how long I was staying. This sure would be a weird place to live if you needed privacy. Yeah, but it's one of the best places on earth if you needed help. And this shows a different idea behind networks and how they regulate behavior, but also how they provide support. So in such a tightly networked community, you have to be very careful in terms of how you behave, because information about how you behaved will get out. So for example, when we, actually with a colleague of mine, we looked at student teams working on projects together, and we asked students how much time they put in and into the team project. And it turned out that one of the strongest predictors was, let's say these two people are on the same team together, it's whether they had lots of shared friends off of the team. And there was actually a quite dramatic effect. If they had lots of shared friends off of the team, that those individuals with shared friends worked a lot harder. They were put in more hours. Not only that, but they put in more hours in the presence of other people on the team. The idea here being that they were enhancing their reputation as being hard workers and creating opportunities for teammates choosing teammates in the future, right? You don't want a reputation as a slacker or free rider on a team. So on the one hand, being in a tight network provides the possibility of support, but on the other hand, people know your business. So let me throw out two examples here. Think about this scenario versus this scenario. Let's say you're the blue node, and what's the advantage? Let's say you're involved in some various economic transactions in the marketplace. What would be the advantage of being in this position? Anyone? Yes.
Well, you can make deals individually with the other people, and they won't know what the deals are. So you can, rip one person off, and the other person, won't hear about it.
That's right. So, you could charge different prices, for example.
Divide and conquer.
You could divide, exactly. You divide and conquer. So that's a real advantage to this scenario. Any other advantages? I mean, I think that captures the essence of it. The other part of it is also the idea of arbitrage, which is that you might buy low here and sell high there, and if they were connected to each other, you couldn't mediate that deal. So, anyone for advantages for this scenario? Yes.
Situations and bargains that are more complex that require all the parties to be in communication with each other, you can do, and you wouldn't be able to otherwise.
That's right. So one part of this is just that whenever you enter into complex deals, and this in part there are two elements to this. So one is if you're making a deal with this group or this individual, do you have a long history, and do you know what you have in your mind when you cut a deal? Because for complex bargains, the bargains are always incomplete, and the less you know each other, the more incomplete they are. So in some sense, having this long-standing relationship decreases the uncertainty in bargains. And then if you have a multi-party deal, that increases exponentially, because if you're dealing with both parties and they've worked with each other and somehow the deal is interdependent, it's better if everyone knows each other. So that's definitely one important part of it. Any other parts of it, advantages to this scenario? Well, let me just return to the idea again of the regulatory nature of networks, which is that that if you make a deal with this person, right, and you know that they make exchanges with this individual and you have a relationship with them, you know that there will be third-party ramifications, reputational consequences, if they take advantage of you in some fashion. Right? And again, keep in mind, the law notwithstanding, that actually much of human conduct and even contracts isn't really regulated by the letter of the agreement. It's regulated by the social system, by the social structure. That if you have some disagreement with your plumber, it's not going to make sense, generally speaking, to go to court, right? But if you happen to have a lot of the same clients, or if the plumber works for a lot of your neighbors, for example, they have a reputational price to pay if they behave badly. So there's this whole idea here that being embedded within a tight network stops people from behaving badly, and acts as an informal court, if you will, the court of the third party. All right. Now I want to talk briefly about coordination and control and the trade-off between centralized and decentralized networks. Now, let us imagine you're on a team, right, and you're doing some task. Now, what would be the advantages and disadvantages of these two team networks? And you can pick a network and say what the disadvantage or disadvantage of it is. Yes?
Disadvantage of the one on the left is that the center node is forced to take on the roles of a coordinator. you know, the outside nodes may not know that they're reinventing the wheel without the center node being really on top of things.
Yeah, so it puts a heavy burden on the center node in this picture. Now, of course, if the node is up to it, that's not such a bad thing, right? So if they're saying, oh, don't you know, talk to this guy and say, don't work on that. You know, this person's working on that. Then such a system could work quite well. But if the center node is not on top of things, such a system could break down very quickly. Any other observations about these two systems? Yes.
I suppose that the centralized network can encourage more creativity because each of the nodes will feel that it's up to them to create new things instead of relying on the central coordinator.
Well, in fact, interestingly, research on teams, for example, shows that, like, there have been experiments looking at these two kinds of networks. And in part, one issue with this network, for example, is that the nodes are the peripheral nodes are not particularly happy with their situation. So the more connected you are, the more satisfied you are, and the more invested you are in the team effort. And which hopefully is associated with creativity, as you said. Any other observations about these two networks? Yes.
Well, the creativity, though, could possibly go the other way, kind of because of the reason we were talking about earlier, that if you have all these people individually working on their own things, they could come up with something original, whereas there might be kind of homogenization in the other situation.
Yeah, and in part it depends on exactly how these two networks operate in ways that we, you can't tell from a picture, because hub-spoke networks can be very quick at diffusing information because it's only two hops from one node to the next. And here, same deal, right? It's two hops from one end of the network to the other. It's just that it really depends on how much of a bottleneck that central node is, and it could be that they're purposefully, there's a purposeful bottleneck. I know also just back on the issue of communication and creativity, like when I structure, I do a lot of collaborative research, but when we're wrestling with an issue, when I do this with collaborators, we try to structure it so that if we have a problem we're trying to resolve, that we each think about it separately and come up with a list of ideas before we talk. And that way, we are sort of envisioning the whole solution space, if you will, or at least a lot of solutions. And if we all went into a room initially and one person had a good idea and we just fixated on that good idea. But in part, it really does depend, what you're suggesting really depends on how these networks are executed. If the central node is a bottleneck, then actually you might get more creativity in the periphery. On the other hand, it may work the other way. Yes? And then.
One more thing is that with the centralized network, if you take out the center of it, you cripple the entire network. Whereas I think the decentralized network would be a lot harder to bring down with like one single action.
That's right. So this, and there's been research done on this kind of. There's been a lot of interesting. There's been a flood of research in recent years on the robustness of networks. For some reason, there's been a lot of interest coming from the government on how to disable networks. I'm not sure why. But in part, it depends on, let's say, if you're attacking a network, which has also been something that there's been, like I said, a great deal of interest in, that depends on what your attack strategy is. If you can hit the central node, then you can disable this network very quickly, right? So if you can strategically target this and say, bam, right, and then suddenly the whole thing falls apart. Whereas here, you know, you can take out any one node and the rest of the system can keep on functioning. But on the other hand, if you're just attacking the average node, then actually the average node here is peripheral. And it's hard to, it can be actually quite hard to disable a hub-spoke network. But you know, clearly if Joe here gets the flu, this particular network completely falls apart. Let's see. Yes?
I was just going to say that the network on the left might have a lot of efficiency advantages, though, assuming Joe is not sick, because you have to determine how communication is going to work in that other network, whereas the structure of that one sort of self-predetermines it, so you don't have to waste time solving that sort of communication problem.
And actually, that mirrors some early experimental work on signal propagation within team networks that found that in decentralized networks, even though again people were happier in the decentralized networks, they actually performed worse because they were sending signals in every which way, and even though what they compared was, for example, an all-channel network. Everyone can talk to everyone else. Turned out that everyone being able to talk to everyone else did not work very well, because you know sending signals off in random directions did not turn out to be very effective. And instead, if you just imposed on the system a network which could be efficient, that the system worked better. Even though the all-channel network, in principle, could encompass any network, right? Because everyone could voluntarily send it to the central node, who could then put the pieces of the puzzle together. They didn't, because they didn't, you know, this person would send it this way, and this person would send it that way, and so on, and it required one person to put all the pieces of the puzzle together. So again, it depends on the problem, but in fact, there was a real challenge with coordination in a decentralized network. There's a wonderful study, actually, by a political scientist, actually a genius, because he's been doing this long study of Florence, Italy, actually going back to the rise of the Medici. There's all these records. John Paget is his name, and he it's required actually spending quite a bit of time in Florence, which is the genius part of the research. But what he found was that the Medici, one of the reasons why the Medici were able to rise to power was that the pro-Medici families had a network that looked like this, and the Medici were in the middle. Whereas the anti-Medici families actually had a much denser network, but there was contested leadership, and they couldn't coordinate their actions. And I think John is spending another few years in Florence to figure out exactly why that happened. So, all right. I think this captures a lot of these ideas about the trade-offs between these two network structures. I'm not prescribing one network structure or another, but there are trade-offs, and in part it depends on the system some things are outside of these pictures. Like, for example, when we talk about the robustness of the network to attack, it depends on whether you can really harden or hide the central node. If you could make this invincible, for example, then this network becomes very robust, right? Because if you can't take out the central node, then you can keep on taking out nodes, but the system hangs together. On the other hand, if you can't do that, then you really want a decentralized network. So there's a lot of it depends, but again, as you know, the sense of what I'm trying to do here is convey what it depends on. I'm going to just spend a few more minutes talking about network structure, recent findings in network structure, and provide a few examples should it work from the internet of some neat things to check out. So unfortunately, this didn't come through too well, but I think you've read a little bit of the recent work by Watts and Strogatz and others on small world networks.
Assume not.
Okay, but let's assume not. Yes. There was this famous experiment by social scientist back in the 60s, Stanley Milgram, called the Small World Experiment. And the basic, what he did was he gave people in Cambridge, I believe it was Cambridge, right? Everything, all this research is in Cambridge or New Haven or what have you, but and gave them a target of this person in Nebraska, which is, you know, psychologically about as far away from Cambridge as you could get, right? And said, we want you to get this letter to this person in Nebraska, but you have to send it through someone that you know. So, and then they can send it to someone that they know, and so on, until it finally gets to the target in Nebraska, where it'll have a list of everyone who had received this letter. And so they did this experiment, and for the chains of letters that were completed, and I should note most were not complete, around 20% were completed, 80% just sort of stopped somewhere en route, it took around 6 hops to get from Cambridge to Nebraska. And the basic, and this is where the idea, the whole term 6 degrees of separation came from. In fact, I think there's now going to be a TV show called 6 degrees of separation. Again, more evidence of the penetration of these network ideas into popular culture. And why, you know, when you think, you know, the idea that everyone or a large population could just have 6 degrees of separation between them is a remarkably compelling idea. And the question is, how could this be, right? Because most of the people we know each other, and if we lined, you know, if we think, well, I know 4 people and they know each other and so on, how could it be that, you know, that there would just be so few hops between me and anyone else in the world or in the country or what have you? And so this question sort of didn't sat there really for a few decades when it was taken up in the late 90s by a theoretical, I think Duncan is, I forget whether he's a mathematician or a physicist. Anyhow, what he showed, and it's actually remarkably simple idea, is that a few long distance ties can dramatically reduce the number of hops or degrees of separation in the system. So let us imagine, for example, in this room, if you were trying to pass a note around, it would be a lot more than 6 degrees of separation just in this room, right? So let's say you could only pass a note to the few people closest to you, right? And how long would it take to get a note from this corner of the room all the way to here? And the answer is it would take, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 hops or something like that. But now let's assume that rather than just your networks being confined just to who you're sitting with, that you're also connected to some people via, you know, friendship. And that even though all of you know each other in this corner and you know everyone near you, that there are a few people that you know who are far away. So you know one person on this side of the room. So you know, I'm sorry, what's your name?
Mary.
You know Mary. So now you can actually hop, you know, we can skip a whole bunch of jumps here and send it to Mary, and then it goes 1, 2. So then suddenly it's only 3 degrees of separation. And so the intuition here, and this is how it's done in a more formal way, mathematically speaking, is that if we think, if we array everyone in a circle, where you can talk to the, let's say, the people to your left and your right and to the individuals on their left and their right, it can still take quite a while to get from one side of the circle to the other. And so what they showed was that if you randomly rewire the network just a little bit, so you take away, you say, all right, you no longer talk to the guy in the green shirt. Sorry, what's your name?
Josh.
You know, you don't talk to Josh, right? But now you talk to Mary, right? And we rewire the network just in random ways, that some of those random rewirings will be long-distance ties and will allow you to shortcut the system, the network, dramatically. And so what they showed was that you can take a very structured network where you just talk to people on your left and your right, and you just add a few random ties in there, and suddenly the degrees of separation in the system radically drop. And I could go through some simple examples to show you just how adding a few long-distance ties can dramatically change the nature of the system. But I think that you've gotten the basic intuition here. Yes?
You said you wouldn't, but I had a question there. Now, the completely random...
So with a completely random network, though, do you lose some of those efficiency advantages if you don't have complete knowledge of the state of the network? It's like if I didn't know the whole network, wouldn't it be better that I could just shoot it somewhere I knew was close?
Yeah.
And because those people are likely to be connected to the people close to them, so does that make the small world network or the random network ultimately more efficient of the two?
Well, there are a few things to note there. That the idea, let me just briefly explain what a random network is. A purely random network is, 5 minutes, okay. So a purely random network is one where you say there's a certain density of ties and we're going to just randomly connect people up. And what happens with a random network is that you know, as you're adding ties, it turns out that, you know, there's going to be lots of little separate little networks, but at some transition point, everyone's going to be connected together, and it's going to turn out to be a small world network in the sense that there'll be very few hops between any two actors. Now, a separate idea, so there are two ideas that you've raised, which are, so that's one issue. Second issue is, how do you navigate this small world? And you actually have to have some knowledge. When you think about the Milgram experiments, you have to have some intuition of what the configuration of the network is in order to make that long distance jump. So if you don't know that, you know, the person on your left actually knows Mary, then you might not send it to the person on your left. And so you actually have to know that the person on your left actually is the type of person who knows someone on this side of the room. And when we think of how real world networks operate, we have a bunch of heuristics which provide us some intuitions as to what networks look like. Like, you know, if someone, you know, you'd say, well, you know, I know someone who grew up in Nebraska, so I bet they know people in Nebraska. Could be wrong, but, you know, it's not a bad guess. And then you say, you know, once I get the letter to Nebraska, we're getting a lot closer, right? So, or I know, you know, my religious leader goes to conferences and knows lots of people, and those people are well connected. I'll, you know, give it to my priest or to my rabbi or what have you, and then they'll know people who are in other places, and they know everyone, right? So you have some sense of who are hubs and who has long distance ties and who has ties to particular locations. And so, you know, we do have certain crude ideas of what the network looks like. And so that's how I think socially we navigate it. Now there's a whole area of computer science that deals with the issue of how to send packets through networks, and that deals with a similar kinds of issues of given only local knowledge of, you know, of the network, how do you send stuff through the network so that's reasonably efficient? And this is a whole growth area within the computer science side of network analysis. Any other questions on small world stuff?
So let's take a break at this point, and when we come back, I want to see pretty pictures.
Okay.
Okay. So just a film change, Tim?
Is there a water around somewhere?
We'll get
it. I always mean to have some water.
So Beck and McClap.
All right. So should we get rolling again?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so I'm just going to, this isn't so pretty yet, but I'll try to do better. There's another big idea has been this idea of scale-free networks, which again ties into this notion that the world is made up of most of us who are spokes and a few extremely well-connected hubs. And the intuition here, if you hear of log-log graphs and what have you, is that if you plot the log of degree of a particular distribution of nodes, that is how many lines are coming from it, and its frequency, that it will end up looking like a straight line, more or less like this. And what that means in reality is that you have, again, these a few very central nodes, and most of the nodes have very few connections, potentially just one connection. And so this has been applied to, for example, the study of the structure of the internet. So if you look at the pointers of World Wide Web pages to each other, it's been shown that it looks a lot like this, with a number of extremely well-connected web pages, but most web pages have very few pointers to them. It's even been shown for sexual networks, for research looking at a number of sexual partners in a study published on in Sweden.
Before you go on, though, David, when you say a log-log, eyes are going to glaze over.
Yeah.
Right? Work at it a little bit. Explain it in real people's language. What does that mean, a log-log curve, and what is the significance of the fact that the line is straight?
Okay. Well, the It's just really the log of the number of ties a particular node has. So let's say here we go 10 to 0. So that would be having one tie versus 100. Versus 10 versus 100 versus 1,000 and the like. And there are a very small number of nodes that have 1,000 connections, and there are a huge number of nodes that have one connection. And it means, if it's a straight line, that means that it's decreasing steadily, so that there are certainly going to be more nodes that have one tie, then have two ties, then have three ties, and so on, all the way to 10, 100, 1,000, and the like. And
but again, the relationship is not linear. It's exponential.
It's when you
reduce the exponential quality of it by measuring in logarithm,
it
comes back down to look like it's linear, but you're really talking about an acceleration. You're really talking about a curve that is zooming upwards.
That's right. So if you made this non-log-log, it would look like this. It would just look asymptotic like that. So you'd have so to really get an accurate picture of this, we would replot this, and you'd say, "Wow, there are a few very connected nodes and a very, very large number of peripheral nodes." And this turns out to be a surprisingly frequent type of network structure.
And this, if I can just break in for a moment, this picture largely represents the distribution of connection on the internet and, for example, is at the base of an initiative by the Berkman Center called Global Voices, which has the design of connecting different small worlds together, actually self-consciously establishing people who are native language speakers in one community who will speak to a foreign language audience and therefore provide what amounts to this long connection in the small world environment that is diminishing by connecting these bridge bloggers, the degree of connection in the space. So that's actually one of the initiatives of the Berkman Center that's been most interesting to watch unfold, and it just won a wonderful journalism prize. And it's has to do basically with political speech at this point, but it is a very generalizable kind of an idea.
And as you'll see also, and this I think connects to exactly this point, actually, it doesn't come across so well in this particular picture, but that hubs can often produce what are effectively small world networks. So if everyone knows, if you all know Charles and none of you know each other, it's still just two hops between any two of you in the system. And so if we think of someone creating a hub here which knows groups, and especially groups that otherwise don't talk, that can radically increase the diffusion of stuff, of information within the system.
And why do you call it scale-free network? In what sense is it free of scale?
Basically, this means that, I'm trying to think of the best way of putting this. It goes back to the idea of fractals, which is that the system looks the same no matter what scale you're looking at. So just like if one is thinking of a coastline, for example, that looks the same if you look at it from space or if you look at it from a few feet away, that if you zoom in on different parts of the network, that it's sort of similar, if you will, to looking at a coastline. I think that's the basic intuition. So the next thing that I think doesn't get enough attention, but I think is one of the most robust findings in the study of social science, really, and social relations, is the idea of homophily, which is that similar people tend to talk to each other, that birds of a feather do indeed tend to flock together. So interestingly, even in the research I did down at the Kennedy School on student networks, which is, you know, quite a cosmopolitan population, we found, not unsurprisingly, that there was a lot of connections within sections, because the incoming students are divided up into sections. But what was a bit surprising to me was how structured networks were around race and religion. Right, so that there tended to be much denser networks within racial groups and within religious groups. And I think this reflects a larger truth within American society in terms of how our networks tend to be structured. And this, in turn, tends to have certain types of ramifications for access to resources and the like, if resources within society are also broken down along those strata within society, and hence the term, for example, old boy network. So I'm going to give you some interesting examples here, fun examples, if on the web, if this works, and maybe I need to do, let's see, how do I switch this here?
Well, it seems to me that this is going to
do I just take that out?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Are we not right about this, Peter?
Yep. That's right. He might have to function off service.
Mm-hmm. Are we up? Yes, we are.
Okay, super. Let me see. Tab here. I'll begin with something called, this is sort of from namebase.org. And this actually is a website that pulls together lots of various public documents about people. And then you can draw a network diagram of showing what people have been mentioned on the same page of a document together. So if I may use you as a guinea pig, Charles.
Always dangerous.
That's right. Let's see what we come up here with here. And this will show you a network picture of who you're mentioned on a page of a document together with. So for example, you're mentioned with my colleague Victor Meyer Schoenberger, but then you're also mentioned, I don't know, you know, a lot of these other people, but you're mentioned on various documents with these people together. So you can get a sense, and then you can zoom in and various ways extend the network based on who those people are connected to. So this provides a sense of the kind of information you might mine to find who is connected to whom. Let me give you another.
So connection networks, for example, in academic fields would show up, and you could imagine any number of.
That's right. So for example, there's been a lot of neat research looking at co-citation, who cites whom, and looking at the structure of fields and looking at those co-citation patterns. And you can look at the emergence of new fields. So there's a field that, you know, isn't a field yet, but then suddenly there tends to be this self-referential pattern that emerges, and you can draw a network picture of who's connected to whom. So you could, or let me give you another one. Let's see if this is going to work. Okay, I thought I downloaded. Oops. No, I don't want that. Okay, I can show you this stuff. This is work I've been doing with folks at the Media Lab at MIT. And this shows you a set of six people. Actually, I think I know most of them. And it shows you it's programmed, they've programmed people's phones to collect data from them. So most of your phones now have Bluetooth in them. Bluetooth is a short-range radio that goes maybe 5 meters or so, and it's meant to replace wires connecting things. So like if I wanted an earpiece to use with my phone, I wouldn't have to have a wire connected to it. It would use Bluetooth. But you can also use Bluetooth. Every Bluetooth device has a unique ID. And so you can program phones so that if they see each other, it stores the information on the phone and then sends it to the researchers every morning. And so, for example, in this small group, you can see what their physical proximity was over the day. And this is where the little lines are popping up. And so you can get a sense of, you know, there are certain points in the day where pairs of them are getting together or that the whole group is getting together and the like, and you can see time is just flying by here. So obviously this is an accelerated picture of the interaction patterns. But we're actually finishing up a paper right now that looks at a much larger number of people. Actually, we collected the equivalent of 35 years worth of observations of a group of almost 100 students within a cohort, what their basically proximity was over the space of a year, as well as what their phone logs were. I think this is one important direction when we think about privacy and potential way of tracking people, the power that we're going to see in the future that can be used by many. Here's another graphic, which this is
can
for...
Can we just, I just yeah. stop you there.
Yeah.
What you're saying is that there's a tremendous interest among security forces in this sort of network analysis. What you're talking about here is surveillance.
Oh, well, what I'm talking about here, our paper isn't so security oriented. It's actually oriented toward understanding collective behavior.
But if I'm running the CIA and I'm listening to you and I'm seeing the pattern of cell phone connections unfolding, I would be very interested in having your skills available so that I could understand the architecture of communication amongst my enemies.
That's correct. Now, I should note that this was based on downloading an applet to your phone so that it would keep track of who you're near, and they had to have their applet on, although actually it keeps track of all, in principle, could keep track of all Bluetooth IDs that you come in contact with. So it sees the printer that you walk by every day and so on, and records that ID. But you actually have to download the applet, and I don't think the CIA has had success with Osama bin Laden loading that into a cell phone yet. But I think in that sense it works a little bit better for researchers trying to study behavior, where you do the whole informed consent thing, and have them load it onto their phones. But here's one that's based on physical location. Let's see. So this is actually one of my co-authors, Nathan, and he tracked his location over time. And each of these, here's a friend of his, Mike's apartment. His apartment is up there. He obviously spends a lot of time there. And then he recorded in his phone locations. And this is all based on cell phone towers. So you can get a fairly good sense of where people are located based on their cell phone towers, what cell phone towers your phone can see. And so, like, now he's at the office, and I guess he has two offices, and then there are a whole set of other locations which he's running among. And this is one, actually, that is more readily trackable, because your phones are regularly looking for cell phone towers, and that information, in principle, can be recorded. Let me see whether I can show this one to you, which is really quite remarkable.
David, we've just got a few minutes left, and I'm very eager to have questions asked, but I find myself kind of struggling here, because I'm wanting to see what I'm hoping my students will see, and I'm not seeing it. It's confusing. It's confusing. The main net that we're interested in is the communications network represented by, integrated media, but net for one. And each of these students has the challenge of making an argument and then putting it up on the net in a way that is designed to attract connection.
Yeah.
Is there anything in what you've studied that would be useful to people thinking from the bottom up? That is, the idea, I would like to reach an audience.
Yeah.
How would I do it in this medium?
Well, this goes back to the when I talked about the two of the key metaphors for thinking about networks. One was regulatory and one was circulatory. This goes back to the idea of thinking of networks as something which circulate things. And so the question is, if you have something that you want to get out there to get people to see, to recognize, what kinds of strategies might you adopt? And there are a number of strategies which actually have been adopted in various ways by private companies trying to propagate goods or what have you. One is by identifying, if you're looking at the network out there, it's not just a question of getting the message out to lots of people, right? Because that would be looking at the world like the world is just made up of lots of nodes, but to think about what are the positions in the network of those individuals or of those organizations. And so suddenly it becomes a lot more important to think about, are we hitting the hubs in that parallel network, for example, because those are the nodes are in a position to rapidly propagate information. And furthermore, not just whether we hit lots of hubs, but do we hit hubs or do we hit different populations that are otherwise disconnected? So if we have this divide in the room, right, and let's say there are no ties that cross this divide, it's not good if I just hit lots of people on this side of the room because none of you will ever be able to get the message. But we need to think, I need to think strategically, I need to maybe get a message to you, but a message to you as well. And that you'll hopefully get the message out then to this group, and you'll get the message out to this group, rather than if I was just aiming for the two of you, even though the two of you might be better connected, each of you, than she is. So it's not just a question of hitting the most connected nodes, but also a sort of diverse set of connected nodes. So I guess those would be the two key points that in terms of propagating ideas out there. I don't know if one of the tech-savvy people, would like to show this one thing while we're talking, but if someone here who's tech-savvy can try to get this going, because I had this working on my computer, but...
Oh, I see. You actually have to download a plug-in?
Yeah. And it failed to, it's the shockwave.
Yeah, you want to try something, Peter? So any questions for David Lazar? Way in the back, Diane.
I was just curious as to what you use this collective behavior research for. Like, do you give it to companies or different organizations?
No, right now it's just this one study, and our basic objective was to understand how does what we can observe with cell phones relate to the more traditional methods of collecting network data. Which is self-report. The traditional way of getting network data is just asking people, who are your friends? And so we did that, and then we found that there were certain predictable differences between what people said and what we observed. So like if we ask, who were you physically near during the day, it turns out that you do a much better job of reporting who you've been near in the last week than who you've been near on average for the last 6 months. You're much better remembering being near friends than people who aren't your friends, because you're obviously near a lot of people who aren't your friends a lot of the time, and it just doesn't register. So right now, that's all we're doing, and we went through the traditional IRB procedures and aren't sharing the data in an identifiable form with anyone. Now, one could imagine, for better or for worse, this being used for many other purposes, whether it's by firms trying to understand what their social structures are and try to make them work better, or by the CIA. And certainly, if one thinks about all the news on the NSA surveillance programs, for example, I would guess that they've done some combination of looking at the phone log network, and actually I have a picture. I won't show you the picture. I've been doing some work on looking at phone log networks as well, of who calls whom. And clearly this is one of the things that NSA has done, combined with content analysis of the phone calls, because we now have pretty powerful software to allow for natural language recognition and the like. So there are a lot of things one could use this for, and varying opinions on how good that is.
I guess. Thanks.
I have a question. I didn't understand how that one of those last graphics you showed about your colleagues' different locations over a certain period of days. I didn't quite understand how that related to the other network systems, because they didn't seem to be about a network. It was just kind of an individual in relation to certain fixed geographical points.
No, thanks. I let that one slip by. Ha. Okay, good. It really has to do with contextualized relationships. So, for example, one of the things that we found in these data that we're looking at is that it's not just whether you're near someone and talk to them, but where you are when you're near them and when that is. So it turns out, for example, that there are a lot of people you're near a lot who are not your friends. But if we looked at who you're near on Saturday night, those people do tend to be your friends. So if you look at the context of the relationships, and I'm going to just give you, again, a bit of a graphic picture here. This provides actually a whole set of people from the data set, and you can see their movements through the day. And this is in the beginning of the day. It's early. Let's see. It's this is the middle of the night, and this is why it's dark. All right. And then it's going to start lightening up in a moment. And I'm going to just accelerate this a little bit. So now it's a little later in the day, and you can see people. This is all based on cell phone towers. You can see people moving around Cambridge. There's Joe and there's Ralph and so on. And this is all just doable based on actually data that cell phone companies routinely collect on you. So this could be reconstructed for any of you if it was so desired. So if you put the communication patterns in context with location and movement, one can infer a great deal more about those relationships. Again, one can just see how potentially intrusive this is if you see, let's say, two coworkers go off to a hotel in the middle of the day or what have you. That could be extremely intrusive information. So, did I see a hand over there? Yes.
This summer, I actually read The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell, and it has a lot of the same ideas. And he talks a lot about these people who are connectors, which I guess in your representation would be the nodes that connect
the
hubs. Lot of points, the bigger nodes. My question is how you mentioned with these nodes that you want to diversify who you connect to, not just the ones that are connected to the most. How do you mean diversify those people?
Well, the key idea actually could be represented just with three nodes, all right? So imagine you and two other people, and the key question in terms of diversification is, do those two people know each other? In which case, you should probably only talk to one of them, if we're thinking in terms of diversification, right? So you should just talk to one of them, and then you talk to someone else who doesn't talk to the person that you've formed a relationship with. So if we just think in terms of diversification, we're trying to hit lots of different spots of the network that don't talk much to each other. And that's really what I'm trying to get at with this notion of diversification. And this connects to the idea that there's a term called structural holes. And think about networks where there are big holes where there aren't many relationships within the network. So, and over here, I guess we have to get the mic. We'll shortcut it this way.
Thanks.
Sure.
How many of these principles are universal to networks generally, and how many are specific to the nodes themselves? I mean, I'm wondering if, can we apply this sort of, the things we learn about networks of people, can we apply them to networks of organizations?
That's an interesting question. The answer is sometimes yes, sometimes no. So, like, if we're thinking of the diffusion of information among organizations, I think it's certainly fair to say that if we're drawing, let's say, inter-organizational ties, like there's a whole bunch of research looking on corporate board overlap, right? Because corporations have corporate boards, and we can see, you know, this corporation happens to be, if you draw a picture of the network of all the overlaps, this corporation happens to be right in the middle. You say, well, they're actually very well situated to get information from lots of other corporations. So that maps really quite well across levels. On the other hand, if we're thinking something that's a little bit more social psychological, like the, you know, there's all this psychology around reputation and the effects of having third parties watch you and thinking, well, you and I have a common friend, and what will they think when we do this and so on, that probably maps far less well to thinking about the relationship between two corporations. Corporations, you know, I don't think really feel guilt in a meaningful way. That's an individual social psychological phenomenon. Other questions? Oh, let me see, I should see whether I can get this one other thing working, because I actually have, there's a simulation which I had on this one, which maybe I'll send you the link to at some point, which shows a tipping point kind of simulation. So it shows, let me just see whether, it's probably not realistic for me to get there quickly enough. But basically, there's a classic work by Tom Schelling, who won the Nobel Prize this past year, and actually he did it while he was, this work while he was at the Kennedy School, which looks at the systemic patterns that emerge from individual behaviors to be with like other individuals. So, for example, if you look at the world as being made up of red people and green people, that if those individuals have a weak preference to be with similar others, like, I just don't want to be in a small minority in my immediate neighborhood, so I want at least the 30% of the people around me to be red like I am, that what emerges out of those individual decisions to not be in a small minority are highly segregated networks where the large majority of ties tend to be with similar others. And this is something, again, this is the idea of how one goes from micro decisions, which are very simple decisions, to the macro patterns that emerge out of those decisions. In this particular case, one sees that weak preferences to be with like others result in very strong segregated patterns in the system. So, any other, I'll try to get that link for you. I at least got this one going, and we can see nighttime is falling, I guess, in Cambridge again. So,
well, nighttime is falling for us here as well.
Yes.
David, thank you very much for joining us and opening up networks to us.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
One thing I just wanted to mention, I run a colloquium series called...